Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Streams of Gold, Rivers of Blood, The Rise and Fall of Byzantium, 955 AD to the First Crusade, by Anthony Caldelis, narrated by Nigel Patterson. Preface. The Byzantines were not a warlike people. They did not typically raise their children to fight with weapons, as happened in many societies around them. Their strategy was famously cautious and defensive. They preferred to pay their enemies either to go away or to fight among themselves. Likewise, the court, at the heart of their empire, sought to buy allegiance with honours, fancy titles, bales of silk, and streams of gold. Politics was the cunning art of providing just the right incentives to win over supporters and keep them loyal. Money, silk and titles were the empire's preferred instruments of governance and foreign policy, over swords and armies. And the Byzantine state and bureaucracy could generate a larger cash flow than any other Christian realm at the time. Even in 1080, with half its territory lost to the Turks, fountains and streams of gold gushed forth from the court of a new emperor desperate to establish his position. That desperation stemmed from the dark side of Byzantine politics. The emperor was always vulnerable to the ambitions of domestic rivals, who resorted to murderous plots and civil war. If gold failed to make an emperor popular, or if he was perceived as weak, the hands of sons were stained with the blood of fathers, and brother would strike down brother. Sitting on the throne in Constantinople was a dangerous and precarious business, but it was business as usual. Our period, however, was exceptional in two other ways. It began with a burst of violence aimed at the empire's neighbours, as Byzantine armies went on the offensive and conquered more land and people than had ever been subjected to the Roman yoke since the conquests of Justinian in the 6th century. A new generation of aggressive soldiers, trained to fight from youth, slaughtered, sacked, and conquered until the empire no longer faced credible rivals. When Simiskis cut down the 5,000 survivors of a battle in 963, the blood ran down into the fields, and the site was renamed the Mountain of Blood. One emperor came to be known as the White Death of the Saracens, another as the Bulgar Slayer. The tide would turn during the 11th century. Three new enemies, the Normans, the Pechenegs, and Seljuk Turks, would fall upon the empire and strip it of many of its conquests. It was now the turn of the Byzantines to suffer horribly, as rivers of blood flowed through their provinces. The present book recounts this sudden rise and fall of an empire on the cusp of the millennium, an empire torn by its own contradictions and threatened by the powers that would fashion a new world. It tells the story of how the streams of gold were drowned by the blood of politics and war. The years between 955, when the general Nikephoros Phokas was placed in command of the army and launched a strategy of aggressive conquest, and 1081, when the general Alexios Komnenos seized the throne amidst imperial collapse and political chaos, were a pivotal period in Byzantine history. During this time, Byzantium embarked on a series of spectacular conquests, first in the southeast against the Arabs, then in Bulgaria, and finally also in Georgia and Armenia. By the early 11th century, the empire was the most powerful state in its geostrategic environment and seemed to have no credible rivals. It was also expanding, economically, demographically, and in time, intellectually too. Yet imperial hegemony came to a crashing end in the third quarter of the 11th century, when political disunity, fiscal mismanagement, and defeat by the Seljuks in the east and the Normans in the west forced Byzantium to fight for its very survival. It gradually had to settle for being one power among many, and just over a century later it was conquered and dismembered by the Crusaders. Byzantium fell behind the curve of history and would never catch up to its peers, especially in the West. Such dramatic fluctuations had not been typical of its past history. How did this happen? What strategies, policies, and personalities shaped the rapid rise and even more rapid collapse of Byzantine power in less than 150 years? This story, which fascinates those interested in Byzantine history because of its dramatic qualities, has to be told anew. It seems to have fallen off the radar of historians. The last to reconstruct the events of this period in detail by using the primary sources was Gustav Schlumberger over a century ago, 1890 to 1905. Yet he did not cover the 11th century collapse, reaching only as far as 1056, the end of the Macedonian dynasty. Schlumberger's work, moreover, which is outdated in many respects and tended toward a romantic narrative style, has not been translated into English. After him, we have mostly general surveys, many of which are good, but they tend to look at events from a greater distance than one would sometimes like, and tend to recycle the view pushed by an early 20th century school of thought, according to which the history of Byzantium in this era was driven by a particular socio-economic transformation. That view, however, is highly doubtful. For these reasons, we need a new narrative history of Byzantium in this era. We now have more sources than were available to Schlumberger, we know more about their limitations, and we are hopefully free of many of the preconceptions that shaped past scholarship. Yet past conjectures, with little support in the evidence, have also become hardened facts or common wisdom. They need to be tested against the evidence. The problem is that much specialised research is now taking place against the background of an implied master narrative of this period that is recycled with minor variations from one survey to the next. This narrative frames and limits research into more particular areas and often predetermines the scope of their methodology. Here, then, is what Streams of Gold, Rivers of Blood hopes to accomplish. It offers a narrative reconstruction of the political and military history of the empire and points to a new understanding of the socio-economic changes that took place in this period. The narrative focuses mostly on the decisions made by the court and their implementation on the frontier. As these decisions were not made in a vacuum, the narrative also tries to expose their structural constraints. On the domestic front, we are dealing not so much with policies as with attempts to reward supporters and protect each regime against potential rivals. Emperors in Byzantium were never safe. They needed to reaffirm their legitimacy constantly, and this governed imperial decisions on all levels. This is also an international history, in the sense that it tries to explain who the people were with whom the Romans of Byzantium were interacting, and what constraints operated along each stretch of the frontier. Though there are notable exceptions, especially Mark Witow for this period, many of our surveys are excessively Byzantinocentric. They point the spotlight at Byzantium and do not illuminate what was going on around it. Enemies along the frontier are named, but little is said about them or the dynamics that were driving their relationship with Byzantium. After many years of heavy reading in Byzantine history, I found that I was still unable to explain to myself who the Hamdanids were or what David of Tours was trying to accomplish. We should no longer write history that way. This book, therefore, takes a different approach. As each area becomes central to the narrative, I introduce the internal dynamics and goals of the Hamdanids, Fatimids, Normans, or Seljuks. As I am not at all committed to Byzantine imperial projects, I have tried to avoid a pro-Byzantine bias. The narrative was also written out of a direct and critical engagement with the primary sources, including literary texts, documentary records, inscriptions, coins, and seals. Modern surveys of this period often rely on previous reconstructions, and they in turn on their predecessors. This sometimes makes it hard to find what primary source ultimately buttresses specific claims. Here, by contrast, the sources will be cited directly, so that listeners know the basis for any assertion and can follow the trail. By returning to the sources and starting anew there, this history clears away a number of fictions and misunderstandings that have entered the record. Like most Byzantinists today, I make extensive use of both Western and Eastern sources. The foreign ones are sometimes better for Byzantine history than the Byzantine ones, but they must all be used critically and sceptically. There is too much gossip, political bias, and rhetorical invention in them. Some Byzantine sources reflect specific authorial projects, as well as the influence of subsequent events and the pull of classical models of writing. There is less factual history in them than one might assume, and some of them are too focused on the capital and Roman politics rather than on foreign lands or even the frontier. I will not survey the main sources here. A guide to the main ones appears at the end of the book. No mere summary can do justice to the problems and temptations that they pose to scholars, so I have written a separate study outlining the many ways in which these literary texts are both more and less than an accurate recounting of the facts. One device that they use, and that still tempts modern historians, is to psychologize the actions of individuals or groups. This definitely makes histories more exciting, but resisting it, as I have done here, hopefully makes them more sober, fair, and accurate. Unlike most of our sources, I try not to take sides, glorify, or condemn. By following all the sources in detail and in tandem, I saw clearly for the first time patterns of imperial behaviour that shaped both domestic and foreign policy. I also came to surprising conclusions, sometimes the opposite of what I expected to find. This was especially the case regarding the imperial collapse of the 11th century. For example, I was forced, against a Psellos-induced bias, to rehabilitate the military leadership of Kostadinos IX Monomachos. I also came to a completely different understanding of the behaviour of the patriarch Mikhail Kirularios during the fateful summer of 1054. But more importantly, beyond the actions of specific individuals, I came to question a particular model of socio-economic transformation that some historians sought to impose on this period. According to this model, the imperial state, ruled by the Macedonian dynasty, was challenged by the landowning magnates of Asia Minor, who were powerful families that were eating up peasant lands and angling to run the empire in a way that benefited their own class. As far as I can tell, this picture is fictitious. It leads to tendentious interpretations of events and individuals that serve a modern agenda, specifically to show how and when Byzantium became feudalized. When we view those events and individuals against the narrative patterns of Byzantine imperial history, a different picture emerges, one of emperors systematically vulnerable to potential enemies and rivals, including most prominently their own courtiers and generals. In sum, political military history will here point to a different understanding of the socio-economic history of this period. This is elaborated in the introduction and the general considerations that conclude the three parts of the book. This book does not focus on general cultural, literary, intellectual, artistic, religious, or economic developments that took place during this period, to which a narrative approach is not ideally suited, but it does include material from those categories. Trade, painting icons, and sending embassies were always occurring in the background, but do not need to be mentioned in banal instances, which are the majority. Major changes in trade policy, especially with the Italian cities, occurred only after the period covered here. and although I am fascinated with the rise or return of the scientific study of the climate and of environmental history, which will contribute new insights in the coming decades, it is unclear how its conclusions can interface with the history of events, as at some point they must. Recent efforts to write narrative history from a climatological angle seem to be reductive, and fail to explain Byzantine expansion in an age of supposed regional collapse. During our period, Byzantium flipped its geographical presence. In 955, it controlled most of Asia Minor, southern Greece, and the corridor from Greece to Thessaloniki and Constantinople. By 1081, it was an almost entirely Balkan state, having in effect exchanged most of Asia Minor for Bulgaria, holding both only briefly, 1018 to 1071. The gravest domestic threat to the emperors at the beginning of our period was the armies of Asia Minor and their officers, such as Phocas, whereas toward the end, the greatest threat came from the armies and officers of Macedonia, such as Vrienios. In this sense, little changed in the underlying structural dynamics of imperial power, only their geographical orientation. Thus, this history will focus on the assets and vulnerabilities of imperial authority, on how emperors sought to win support and stave off enemies, first in a phase of rapid imperial expansion, then during a phase of consolidation and equilibrium, and finally during a sudden defeat and rapid decline. As with the title of the book, the chapter titles have also been borrowed from expressions in contemporary sources that seemed strikingly relevant. A note on transliteration. As a rule, I transliterate Byzantine names from the Greek, for example Ioannis and Theodoros, rather than Latinize or Anglicize them, which is a mildly offensive practice that persists almost uniquely in the case of Byzantium. Public discourse in recent decades increasingly strives to recognize cultural distinctiveness and use foreign names out of respect. Renaming everyone for convenience projects cultural dominance, or worse, assumes it. Thus, filling Byzantium with people falsely named John, however innocuous it may once have been, is a convention whose time is up. Note that transliteration captures spelling, not phonology. I have tried to do the same with names from all the cultures that appear in this book, only I do not mark long vowels in Arabic, just as I do not in Greek either. One exception to this approach is for individuals who were already well known by the English forms of their names, such as Justinian and Basil II. A rough standard for well known is whether that name is used in two or more English book titles. The same goes for place names. Another exception is for the Western leaders of the First Crusade, for whom I have also used conventional names. Introduction. The Byzantine Empire in the 10th century. Romania. In the 10th century, what we call Byzantium was still just the Eastern Roman Empire, with Constantinople as its capital. After the invasions by Arabs, Avars, Slavs and Bulgars in the 7th century, its territory had been reduced to Asia Minor, Thrace, southern Greece and southern Italy. But it was still the Roman Empire. More accurately, it was the Empire of the Romans. It had a proper name, Romania, which had been in use since the 4th century. Its ruler was the Vasilevs of the Romans, which in Greek just meant king, but we call it an empire because it was descended from the ancient Imperium Romanum. The Byzantines also ranked themselves and their ruler as superior in standing, prestige, culture, antiquity, and world historical importance, even on a theological level, a claim that was often accepted by their neighbours, especially smaller Christian powers. The Byzantine Vasilevs was not like any other king. By the 10th century, however, Byzantium was not much of an empire by the most common modern definition of that word, namely rule by one ethnic or religious group, a minority of the population, over a multi-ethnic majority of subjects. In Byzantium, a Roman was anyone who was raised speaking Greek, was Orthodox Christian, and considered himself a member of the polity of the Romans as defined by its laws, customs, religion, and state institutions. This accounted for the majority of the population, approximately 10 million people, though not everyone. There were still unassimilated Slavic groups in the Peloponnese and Greece, Armenians and Georgians in the eastern provinces, foreign contingents in the army, Paulician heretics, and Jews, all of whom could be more or less assimilated to the dominant cultural norms. Overall, Romania looked more like a Roman kingdom that had minorities than a true multi-ethnic empire, though in the later 10th and 11th centuries, the balance would shift toward imperial rule over recently conquered or annexed foreign territories. Still, the boundaries between Roman and barbarian were never as stark as our sources suggest. The Byzantines were xenophobic and generally prejudiced against outsiders, but at the same time it was easy for foreign individuals and groups who entered the empire to assimilate to Roman ways, and by the second or third generation to become Romans with no distinguishing traits. Over the centuries, Goths, Huns, Slavs, Arabs, Persians, and people from many other backgrounds were assimilated, usually through military service or land settlements. Being Roman was a cultural-political identity that could be taken on. In addition, the emperors claimed hegemony over smaller Christian states in Italy, the Adriatic coast, and the Caucasus. In practice, these were mostly autonomous, but in the eyes of Constantinople, they were satellites, and some would be ceded or just annexed in the Age of Conquest. By ancient or medieval standards, and for a realm of its size, Byzantium was culturally homogeneous, socially integrated, and unified by exclusive and sovereign state institutions. It is important to stress how different it was in this respect from Western medieval kingdoms. Unlike the lands of the former Western Roman Empire, the core territories of the realm were not quasi-autonomous domains, ruled by hereditary local lords, with whom the emperors had to engage in internal diplomacy to obtain support, tribute, or soldiers. They were rather administrative provinces, governed by magistrates sent out from the capital for brief periods in rotation. Taxes, recruitment, law, religion, and salaries were fairly standardized, and administered across imperial territory by bureaus that were headquartered in Constantinople. These grids of administrative coherence, including the church, were parallel, hierarchical, and centralized, and they bound the provinces to the capital in overlapping ways. In the 10th century, Byzantium was second to none in the efficiency of its taxation, the resources that it could generate for use by the state, the sophistication and complexity of its bureaucratic apparatus, and the authority that the state could claim in governing the lives of all Romans. The Roman people, moreover, were not divided by law or custom into castes or fixed classes, nor was nobility claimed as a right of blood by a handful of families. The same law, a Greek version of Roman law, applied to everyone, and families became powerful only when they succeeded in court politics and managed to retain imperial favour. Thus, even though some benefited from inherited connections, prestige, and wealth, there was also considerable political mobility and turnover. In a law, the Emperor Basil II speculated that the lifespan of a powerful family was between 70 and 100 years, though some lasted longer. But at the same time, a poor man could become powerful by rising up and obtaining court titles. In Byzantium, then, nobility of family was a rhetorical way by which to praise the rich and powerful for as long as they remained in power. It corresponded to no legal fact or fixed social reality, but rather reflected a desire for a certain kind of social image. It is probably better to speak of a ruling elite who were powerful because they held offices at the court, in the army, and in the church, and whose membership changed over time, often due to shifts in imperial favour. It was an aristocracy of service, not blood, despite the occasional rhetoric, and it organised power through title and office rather than through family. Likewise, imperial power itself was as much institutional as based on personal relations, a fact that historians have forgotten recently. We will see, for example with the Paphlagonians, that nobodies could step into positions of authority and command obedience until they became unpopular, like anyone else. This picture so far gives the impression that emperors were all powerful. The monarchy did control all institutions of the state and could usually impose its will on the church as well, so long as it did not try to change fundamental aspects of doctrine or ritual practice. There was no independent court of appeal, no legal limit to an emperor's power. But in practice, the emperors were highly vulnerable and insecure, for reasons relating to the nature of the monarchy since its creation by Augustus, and stemming in part from its elective ideology. There was no hereditary or absolute right to power. Accession to the throne was accomplished politically or militarily, but either way one had to obtain the consent of the Roman people, especially the populace of Constantinople, the army, magistrates, court, clergy, and whatever special interest groups were powerful at any time. Emperors were created when those elements of society agreed to acclaim them publicly. If an emperor was popular, he could arrange this on behalf of an heir or successor. But if the emperor was unpopular, it was only a matter of time until someone else rose up, through a palace coup or military rebellion, to take his place. Thus, both emperors and rivals, that is, potential emperors, looked to the legitimating power of Roman society, a broad social field. They always tried to remain popular and monitored public opinion as closely as they could, for it could promise opportunity or spell doom. Legitimacy was not won once and for all. It had to be maintained politically in an ongoing process. Dynasties were only provisional arrangements of power, vulnerable to challenge and liable to be suspended or overthrown. There were no guarantees in the transmission of imperial power, as no one had a right to inherit the res publica, politia in Greek, the public affairs of the Roman people, which could not be privately owned. This was the republican basis of the imperial monarchy. The emperor was answerable to the polity, the politia. To mitigate this systemic insecurity, the monarchy promoted the narrative of divine election, and most Romans were happy to regard their vasileffs as God's favourite. But when their mood soured, God never rescued any emperor. Thus the throne was up for grabs, and the emperors were always trying to preempt or suppress rivals and protect themselves against plots and rebellions. This framework for the exercise of power shaped the empire's military and foreign policy, for in effect there were two main political arenas in Romania: Constantinople and the frontier armies. The emperors had to be watchful of both, which feature prominently in our sources. Given that the armies, especially ambitious officers, posed a great threat to the survival of any regime in Constantinople, military policy aimed as much to mitigate that threat as to defend the empire from foreign enemies. The history of Byzantium was to a great degree shaped by the tension between the court and the armies, which played out against a backdrop of foreign war. Let us look more closely at these two major sites of contestation. Imperial governance. Constantinople, also known as New Rome or just the city, was the beating heart of the Eastern Empire, situated on the Bosporus, at one of the most strategic and beautiful locations in the eastern Mediterranean. As a city and imperial capital, it surpassed in size, power, and sheer magnificence any other place in the Christian world. Its monumental architecture and core layout were still those of the late antique capital built by Constantine, Theodosius, and Justinian, though damage from fire, riots, and earthquakes would everywhere have been apparent. Still, the Byzantines spared no praise for it. For them, Constantinople was the
sample complete. Ready to continue?